every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. This is Democracy Now!
With the latest orders, they are essentially now confined to one-fifth of the territory. So you basically ask people to go again to one-fifth of the territory and empty up the land. That's what prompted me to call it ethnic displacement and ethnic cleansing.
Israel is committing ethnic cleansing in Gaza. That's according to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. We'll speak with him in Geneva. But first, dozens are killed in Gaza in just the last 24 hours.
The F-16 shook the place. It struck this place, as you can see. Pools of blood, piles of martyrs. I mean, if you had seen the scene from the beginning, there were piles of martyrs.
We'll speak with an American doctor volunteering in Gaza about what he's seeing on the ground. Then heat domes from the United States to Europe.
I think we keep hearing about climate change, but I think we're definitely feeling it now. Because I think when I was younger, and summer wasn't like this. It was some days, but nothing like this. So we're definitely seeing a change in the weather, 100%. So hopefully we can reverse it.
We'll speak with climate scientist Michael Mann. According to his latest report, heat domes and flooding have nearly tripled. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks on Gaza killed nearly 100 Palestinians Monday, including at least 39 people who died when an Israeli warplane bombed a seaside cafe in northern Gaza City. Among those killed were children celebrating a birthday party. The prominent visual artist Franz Al-Salmi and the photojournalist Ismail Abu Hattab. He's at least the 227th Palestinian journalist killed by Israeli attacks on Gaza since October 2023. Palestinian journalist Bayan Abu Sultan was injured in the assault, along with dozens of others. Separately, Israel attacked tents housing displaced people in the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza. Al Jazeera reports it's the 10th time Israeli forces have attacked the medical complex. This comes as Gaza's hunger crisis continues to deepen. In Khan Yunis, Dropsite News reports 29-year-old Ayub Saber Abu al-Hussein died from severe malnutrition caused by the Israeli blockade. The United Nations warns the territory has completely run out of infant formula, putting hundreds of babies at imminent risk of death. Already, at least 66 Palestinian children have died of acute malnutrition due to Israel's blockade, according to Gaza officials. Meanwhile, Israel killed at least 15 people seeking food in southern Gaza at a militarized aid distribution site run by the U.S. and Israeli-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. 50 others were wounded in the airstrike.
These people had gone to eat. They went to get a morsel of food to eat. They said they were distributing aid. How do you call it aid? Then you shoot at people's children. Where is the world? Where are the people? You tell me aid and it's documented. Then why do you kill us?
With the latest attack, nearly 600 Palestinians have been killed while attempting to get food and aid at GHF sites. On Monday, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders condemned the shadowy group's operations as, quote, slaughter masquerading as humanitarian aid. After headlines, we'll go to Gaza for the latest. Here in New York, police arrested at least 28 people Monday as they ended a 40-day fast outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations by escalating their protest. Among those arrested was former Navy Corpsman and Veterans for Peace organizer Mike Ferner, who poured animal blood on the mission's entrance to condemn U.S. support for Israel's military.
Here, United States, have some blood. You like shedding it all over the world so much? There you go. How about some blood?
On Capitol Hill, U.S. senators held another marathon session overnight Monday ahead of a final vote on President Trump's massive package of tax cuts for the wealthy and cuts to social programs benefiting poor and working families. At least two Republicans have broken ranks with party leaders to oppose Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina cited deep cuts to Medicaid, which he says would devastate his state. And Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky cited the Congressional Budget Office's finding that the bill would add $3.3 trillion to the national debt. Under enormous pressure, Senator Tillis says he will not run in the next election. The Department of Justice has issued new directives aimed at stripping naturalized U.S. citizens of their status if they're accused of committing a crime or of posing a threat to the United States. A DOJ memo published earlier this month said naturalized citizens subjected to these civil proceedings would also not be entitled to an attorney. There are an estimated 25 million naturalized citizens living in the U.S. This comes as in an unprecedented move. Trump's DHS has built a national citizenship surveillance database in collaboration with the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, to store information from federal immigration agencies and the Social Security Administration. President Trump's traveling to Florida today for the opening of a new immigration jail that officials have dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, an isolated airfield in the Everglades that's been turned into a mass detention tent camp. The ICE jail is expected to hold up to 5,000 people awaiting deportation, costing an estimated $450 million a year to operate. Over the weekend, Miccosukee tribe leaders and environmental activists rallied outside the site after groups filed a lawsuit attempting to block the camp's opening until it undergoes an environmental review as required by federal law.
This is almost like we're living in a foreign country. They didn't do any environmental impacts. They didn't do anything about the housing, whether it's going to be safe. They're leaving these people out in the middle of hurricane season. This is just absolutely ridiculous.
Florida's Attorney General and Trump ally, James Uthmeyer, has said Florida will not invest much in security as the jail is surrounded by alligators and pythons. As protests grow against ICE raids nationwide, California activists are rallying in support of farm workers who have not returned to work in fields out of fear of arrest and deportation. Reuters estimates up to 70% of farm workers have been forced out of work as masked federal agents target their places of employment.
One wakes up in the morning in fear because many of us will leave our house and probably won't come back. And I think that's the concern of everyone who goes out to work in the mornings, to the fields mostly. Concerns about the sun, the heat, and yet another high concern is that many of us might not have the joy to return home. Many do, others do not.
Immigrant rights activists are calling on the Soccer Federation, FIFA, to ban ICE and other federal agents from its games during the 2025 Club World Cup hosted across U.S. cities, as well as next year's anticipated FIFA World Cup. Ahead of the start of the tournament, Customs and Border Protection vowed to be suited and booted at games. Advocates rallied outside FIFA's offices in Coral Gables, Florida, Monday.
We're here because we want people to feel safe going to their games. We don't want for people to be sitting at these games and watching families be separated, wondering whether or not ICE is going to come to their seat in the stands and ask them for their papers.
A new investigation reveals Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem secretly took a personal cut of $80,000 in political donations made to her dark money group, American Resolve Policy Fund, and failed to disclose it before joining the Trump administration, which could be illegal. ProPublica reports in 2023, while Noem was governor of South Dakota, the group, quote, routed funds to a personal company of Noem's that had recently been established in Delaware. The company's name is Ashwood Strategies. The news adds to mounting allegations of corruption in Trump's cabinet. In March, while Noem toured El Salvador's mega prison Cecat, she was infamously photographed wearing a gold Rolex Cosmograph Daytona watch that costs around $50,000. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to a 1971 campaign finance law that limits coordination between political parties and candidates. The challenge was brought by the National Republican Congressional Committee and two candidates, including then-Senator J.D. Vance. In a statement, Public Citizen called on justices to reject the challenge, writing, quote, in the 15 years since the Supreme Court Citizens United abysmal decision opened the floodgates to unlimited corporate and billionaire campaign spending, the corruption of American politics has gone from bad to worse, Public Citizen wrote. Iran's judiciary said Sunday Israel's attack on Tehran's Evin prison last month killed at least 71 people, including guards, prisoners, visiting family members, and people living nearby. Israeli officials haven't said why they targeted the prison, which has for decades housed political prisoners and dissidents. Meanwhile, Iran has rebuffed a request by the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog to visit nuclear sites bombed by Israel and the U.S. last month. On Monday, Iran's foreign minister called the request by the International Atomic Energy Agency chief Rafael Grossi meaningless and possibly even malign in intent, unquote. On Sunday, Grossi said he's convinced the U.S. attack on Iran failed to obliterate its nuclear program, as President Trump has repeatedly claimed.
They can have, in a matter of months, I would say, a few cascades of centrifuges spinning and producing enriched uranium, or less than that. Frankly speaking, one cannot claim that everything has disappeared and there is nothing there.
In climate news, a massive heat dome is bringing record temperatures to much of Europe, with forecasters warning of even more extreme heat in the coming days. Spain and Portugal just recorded their hottest ever June temperatures. France saw its first forest fires of the season erupt, while Italy put nearly two dozen cities under red alert heat advisories. In Turkey, more than 50,000 people have been evacuated. Fast-spreading wildfires. This comes after most of North America sweltered under warmer-than-average temperatures in June, with over 3,000 record-high temperatures recorded across the U.S. during last week's heat wave. For the first time in its history, Alaska issued a heat advisory in June after temperatures in Fairbanks reached 86 degrees Fahrenheit. We'll have more on heat domes and the climate crisis later in the broadcast when we speak with climatologist Michael Mann. Nearly half the population of Tuvalu has applied for visas to permanently relocate to Australia as the low-lying Pacific Island nation faces an existential catastrophe from rising sea levels. Australia has agreed to accept 280 climate refugees annually from Tuvalu's 11,000 citizens. And in Hong Kong, the opposition League of Social Democrats announced Sunday it'll disband after its members were prosecuted and jailed under a national security law imposed by Beijing in 2020. The crackdown came after party leaders helped organize massive street protests in 2019 in support of multi-party democracy in Hong Kong. This is Chan Po-ying, chair of the League of Social Democrats.
Over the 19 years since our founding, we have endured hardships of internal disputes and the near total imprisonment of our leadership while witnessing the erosion of civil society, the fading of grassroots voices, the omnipresence of red lines, and the draconian suppression of dissent. Despite such adversities, the League of Social Democrats persisted, doing what little we could just to remain true to our founding values and beliefs.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman, back in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the heat dome in Switzerland, where I just came from, was incredible. And we're going to talk more about that in a bit with the head of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. But now to Gaza. In northern Gaza City on Monday, an Israeli airstrike bombed a popular seaside cafe, killing at least 40 people. The Al-Baqa Cafe was a popular destination for Palestinians in Gaza looking for internet access, including journalists. Photojournalist Ismail Abu Hattab was killed. Palestinian journalist Bayan Abu Sultan was injured in the attack. Also among the dead was prominent visual artist Franz Al-Salmi and a group of children celebrating a birthday. Al Jazeera journalist Hani Mahmoud reported the attack on the cafe occurred without any warning, he said. At least 95 people in Gaza were killed Monday. Separate attacks hit a tent encampment in the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza and the Yafa School, which had been sheltering hundreds of people. Israeli forces killed at least 15 people seeking food in southern Gaza at a militarized aid distribution site run by the U.S. and Israeli-backed group, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. 50 others were wounded. This is Hassam al-Hawadri, an eyewitness.
Hunger, hunger, hunger. No matter how much I tell you hunger, there is hunger in Gaza. There is humiliation. This is humiliation. You bring me aid to kill me. You said this is aid and it is documented and signed. Then why these massacres? These people had gone to eat. They went to get a morsel of food to eat. They said they were distributing aid. How do you call it aid? Then you shoot at people's children. Where is the world? Where are the people? You tell me aid and it's documented. Then why do you kill us?
More than 600 Palestinians have been killed while attempting to seek aid from the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. Already, at least 66 Palestinian children have died of acute malnutrition due to Israel's blockade. That's according to Gaza officials. For more on these latest developments in Gaza, we go to Gaza, where we're joined by Dr. Abdul Basit Khan, who is a neurosurgeon volunteering with Rama Worldwide at the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. He's an American doctor volunteering in Gaza right now. Thank you so much for being with us, doctor. I understand just before we went to air, there was another bomb right near you.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, in fact, there were four bombings just south of the Khan Yunis complex while we were joining the phone call. These are residential areas, indiscriminate bombing. And I'm sure after this call, I'll go treat the patients in the emergency room.
And Dr. Khan, some of the patients that you've been treating, could you talk about the injuries they're suffering?
Yes, definitely. So I'm a neurosurgeon. I treat brain and spine pathologies. That was just another bomb. I've been treating mostly blast injuries. My patients are all dislocated and living in tents. They are being indiscriminately bombed by the Israeli occupation forces. My first day here, within 2 hours of arriving, I operated on a 10-year-old girl who was in her tent and was struck by a bomb. Father said he was outside of the tent. A bomb came from the sky. She became immediately unconscious. Came to me. She had shrapnel going through both, ripping through both frontal lobes. I operated on her that night. Thankfully, she's doing well. These types of bombings affect entire families. I was later consulted on an adult woman in the ICU who had shrapnel penetrating the front of her neck, causing a large neck hematoma. I was consulted by the head and neck surgeon because there was shrapnel lodged in her spine. That woman turned out to be the mother of the patient I had just operated. The poor father is here going between both ICUs. These kinds of conditions and these kinds of scenarios are very common. In fact, just before I logged into this call, I took care of one young boy, 8 years old, similar story. In the tent, he has shrapnel ripping through both frontal lobes. We will soon operate the patient as soon as we have an operating room available. Everything is in resource limitation in Gaza. Then later in the emergency room, I took care of his father, who also had shrapnel injury to the back of the head. These are the kinds of patients I'm seeing.
A few days ago, Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, reported that Israeli soldiers, IDF soldiers that they've interviewed, said that they were ordered to fire on unarmed crowds near food distribution sites. There have been over 500 Palestinians killed since May at these food distribution sites. What are your other colleagues talking to you about the kinds of people who have been killed or wounded by gunfire at these distribution sites?
It's an excellent question. The injuries from the aid sites are very common, and we're seeing these injuries every single day. I myself, yesterday night, we had a patient come from the aid site in a delayed fashion after he was struck with shrapnel in the back of the head. The day prior, I had seen a 25-year-old man who had a single gunshot wound with a high-velocity rifle entrance in the posterior aspect, back of the neck. They shot him in the back of the neck, and it exited the front part of the chest. It severed his spinal cord. He can no longer move his arms or his legs, and he will remain like that for the rest of his life. He's only 25 years old. I reviewed with my colleagues the cases that they're seeing. One of the cardiologists here, he saw a patient who had been shot in the chest at the aid site. Had blood collecting around his heart, preventing his heart from beating. They had to emergently drain the bleeding from around the heart. One of my colleagues is an orthopedic surgeon. Yesterday, he amputated three limbs of different patients, young, healthy, civilian patients, just seeking aid. And as you can imagine, that's very morbid to lose an arm or a leg. My other colleague is a urologist. He took care of three patients yesterday who were all separate patients shot in the scrotum. Two he operated on, and one he is managing conservatively. The one he's managing conservatively is a seven-year-old boy. A seven-year-old boy was with his father in the aid station and was shot in the scrotum. And unfortunately, one of my colleagues, the cardiologist, saw a patient who was dead on arrival. Seven-year-old boy was shot, multiple gunshots at the aid station. So these cases are very common.
Just to be clear, the medical charity, Doctors Without Borders, is saying that this Israeli-U.S. food distribution scheme in Gaza is degrading Palestinians by design, forcing them to choose between starvation or risking their lives for minimal supplies. With over 500 people killed, nearly 4,000 wounded while seeking aid, MSF says, Medecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders says, this scheme is slaughter masquerading as humanitarian aid and must be immediately dismantled. Dr. Basit Khan, you're a doctor. I know you can't talk about politics here, but you are seeing what's happening right there on the ground. Are your patients, those that are conscious, talking about having gone to get food?
Yes. So usually it's the young adult men that are going to get the food on behalf of the family. But like I said, even seven-year-old boys have gone with their families to attempt to get food. Beyond the patients, it's not just the patients, Amy. Even the doctors here are suffering from starvation. There's minimal food available. No one in Gaza is eating meat. I haven't seen one person eat meat since I've arrived. I'm talking to my neurosurgery colleagues who are native Palestinians living here and working here in Gaza. Their situation is very dire. One of the colleagues told me he lost 50 kilograms. That's almost 100 pounds since the start of the occupation and the war. Food insecurity is rampant from all levels of society, from the poor to the, you know, even the physicians are not eating. And this stretches to the patients as well. The 10-year-old girl that I mentioned, we operated on her the same night she came. Thankfully, she had a good neurological recovery. The next morning, I wanted to start her with tube feeding so she could get some nutrition to recover from her injury. I talked to the pediatric ICU doctor, who is a Palestinian native, lives in Gaza, has been working here for the entire war. He said, yes, I agree with you. We should give the tube feeding, but it's not available. There is no tube feeding in the pediatric ICU for the 10-year-old girl in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. It's not available.
Finally, doctor, you are an American doctor who works in Houston. You're a neurosurgeon. What is it like to be there at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis for you? Does anything in your life experience compare?
No, definitely this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life by far. You know, I had been following the occupation since the beginning, and you read about the devastation, the destruction, the humiliation, the hunger, the starvation, the death. And even just, it just does not do it justice. Everywhere you look, the hospital is overcrowded. Families are living in the hospital. The supplies to do the operations are limited. The Israeli forces will not allow you to bring such supplies in. We're using single-use items, for example, drill bits and such tools that you're supposed to dispose of after each use. They're not available, so we cannot dispose of them. We're reusing them and reusing them and attempting to sterilize them. The operations that take me maybe 45 minutes to 1 hour in Houston are taking me 2 to 3 hours here in Nasser Hospital. Nasser Hospital itself was a victim of bombing. There's no windows in Nasser Hospital because they've all been destroyed. There's no windows, meaning the bugs come into the hospital. You know, all of the operations I've done in the operating room, because there's no air filtration system left, there are bugs coming into my operating field. This situation is so dire and so unacceptable. I'm totally flabbergasted. At the same time, I have to really respect and recognize my Palestinian colleagues. You know, I've only been here a short time. My Palestinian colleagues, the neurosurgery team here, they are themselves displaced from the European General Hospital, the European Gaza Hospital. They each have been relocated more than 7 times each. The doctors are living in the tents, but they still come here. Every other day, they take 24-hour call, 2 teams. They have not been paid salary. And they have been managing these patients with such little technology, such little tools, and they're managing them to a very high degree. So I really respect and admire my colleagues here. And no, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my whole life.
Dr. Abdul Basit Khan, thank you so much for being with us. Neurosurgeon volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, speaking to him in Gaza. Although the Israeli military, the Israeli government, Netanyahu, the prime minister, does not allow international journalists to cover on the ground what's happening in Gaza unless they are embedded. You can see it is not difficult to speak to people on the ground. And you should call the networks and ask them to do that. It is absolutely critical to understand what Dr. Khan is saying. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced he'll be coming to the U.S. next week to meet with President Trump and other officials in the administration. He says the meetings will discuss how to, quote, capitalize on the success of the attack on Iran by Israel and the United States.
I am expected to travel next week to the United States for meetings with the President of the United States, Donald Trump, with Vice President Vance, with the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio, with the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, with the President's Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, and with the Secretary of Commerce. We have a few matters to finalize beforehand in order to reach a trade agreement, in addition to other issues. There will also be meetings with congressional and Senate leaders and security meetings, which I will not elaborate on here. These matters follow the great victory we achieved in Operation Am Kalavi. Capitalizing on success is no less important than achieving it.
Will Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, be talking also about Gaza? We're joined now by Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst from Gaza, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for being with us, Mohammed. Many have said that Israel's attack on Iran, that part of it was to distract from what's happening in Gaza, the intensification of the violence. Can you talk about what's happening there in the West Bank?
Thanks so much, Amy, for having me. Yes, precisely. I was in Brussels right before the Israeli attack on Iran, and Gaza became a very prominent headline there. There was so much momentum that European leaders couldn't escape away from it. They had to save face. And as soon as the attack on Iran happened, you can see them immediately having a giant moment of relief. They were delighted that Gaza would disappear from headlines, and they're very keen to keep it this way. Right now, the situation there, you basically have Israel having lined up the entire population like ducks in less than a fifth of Gaza's area. They issued over 50 evacuation orders since March 18th. The latest evacuation orders were issued to the most populated areas in Gaza City itself, the areas where there was some ability to maintain organized human life. And basically, Israel is asking them to evacuate to the very areas that have been evacuated already, to an area that is already under an evacuation order, Deir el-Balah and Zawaida. And basically, recently, an Israeli officer called an elderly Gazan, and he said, "You have to evacuate now. We're issuing mass evacuation orders for your area." The old man responded with tears in his eyes, and he said, "Go ahead, bomb us. We have nowhere to go. We don't even have physical energy to run away." And he started to beg the Israeli officer, literally, he started to beg him to bomb them. He said, "Just let us rest. Bomb us now." And then when the argument escalated, he started begging the officer for food. He said, "If you're going to send planes here anyways, just let them drop any food on us so that we can get any energy to move from this area." And he started to plead with the officer and saying that, "I was a worker in Israel. A lot of the people here around me used to work in your country. We built your country from scratch, and none of this worked." The conversation ended without having any sort of humane reaction from the Israeli officer other than leave the area. The evacuation orders are there only as a pretext to allow Israel to carpet bomb, to indiscriminately bomb a whole area nonstop. So my colleagues on the ground have been saying that since last week, the intensity of the Israeli bombardment is the largest they've ever seen in months. There's basically an airstrike every other minute. There's nonstop artillery fire, gunfire, machine gun fire, as well as Israeli quadcopter drones that are swarming Gaza and shooting people at random. In addition to what you see now with the rampant starvation, a single bag of wheat flour costs about $50. A single pound of sugar costs about $35, and Israel allows a maximum of what would be the equivalent in the GHF sites. It's 20 trucks per day, which is the equivalent of 4 ounces of food, 125 grams of food per person per day, as the only thing. In any concentration camp in human history, people got more food than they do right now in Gaza. So that's the picture you have. With the death trap being the cherry on top, Israel basically laying a mousetrap with fake cheese to Gazans to go to GHF distribution sites to only get shot. It's now basically etched in the minds of everyone I know in Gaza that trying to find food is synonymous to death, especially for kids. They associate it immediately with the killing or the death of loved ones. So my close friend Ibrahim in Gaza City right now, he told me that whenever he tries to leave home to go look for food, his son starts to scream and kick and cry because he understands that leaving for to try to find food is a death sentence, and he would rather that they starve than finding his own family being killed. But nonetheless, and that's the most depraved part of it, Amy, is that my friends and family on the ground tell me that once the starvation gets too severe, it dulls your senses. It sort of shuts down your brain. An empty stomach means an empty mind. And your basic survival instinct forces you to walk, to march like a zombie towards these distribution centers, only to get shot on the way. The chances of survival there are very slim. So the overall picture is just a genocide.
And Mohammed Shahada, this carnage, this genocide is occurring while here in the United States, the Trump administration yesterday approved $510 million in additional arms sales to Israel. Your response to this continued U.S. financing of this killing?
Well, basically, at this rate, anyone that wants to know knows what's going on. You have a record number of Israeli experts, human rights experts, that are saying this is a genocide unfolding in Gaza. And Trump's only response has been twofold: to keep showering Israel with gifts, with weaponry, and at the same time to pretend that there is sort of, quote, a breakthrough, an imminent breakthrough in the ceasefire negotiations. Let me be clear, there is none. There are no negotiations to begin with. Qatar yesterday announced there's no progress, there are no negotiations. Hamas as well said there is no nobody is reaching out to us to ask for negotiating a ceasefire or the release of Israeli captives. It's just the mirage, the facade of negotiations that Netanyahu and Trump keep reviving every time Gaza jumps back to the headlines, as to numb, to suppress any coverage of Gaza, to create some false hope that there is a breakthrough, to sort of circumvent or suppress any room for pressure on Israel. And the picture is not any better in Europe. Like, if you look at European escalating rhetoric towards Israel, it was also an empty maneuver to just circumvent pressure to act. So, for example, European governments like Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Norway, Western governments, they basically recently imposed sanctions on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. The sanctions were very well choreographed, articulated in a way as to evade holding the Israeli government accountable. They only penalized the two ministers for statements, not actions, and for statements on the West Bank, not Gaza. Because if they had looked into actions or statements on Gaza, it would have incriminated the entire Israeli government. So what we see is basically just mere headline-grabbing gestures that are there to buy time while at the same time continuing to funnel unrestricted, unconstrained support for the very genocide that those countries are claiming to be concerned about.
Mohammed Shahada, we want to thank you for joining us from Copenhagen, writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. This news from Al Jazeera: Britain's High Court has ruled the government's decision to allow the export of Lockheed Martin F-35 jet parts to Israel is lawful, despite accepting that they could be used in breach of international humanitarian law. Next up, we go to Geneva to speak with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk. He says Israel's committing ethnic cleansing in Gaza. Back in 20 seconds.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime. It's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus of complaint. It's a sure sign.
Tomorrow's going to be a better day. That's Billy Bragg singing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I was in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, on Monday, at the headquarters of the United Nations Human Rights Council. I had the chance to sit down and speak with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, about a number of issues. In today's segment, we're going to look at Israel's attack on Gaza. We spoke soon after Israel issued new forced evacuation orders for Palestinians in areas of northern Gaza. In a statement last month, Volker Türk just characterized Israel's actions in Gaza as ethnic cleansing, saying, quote, "This latest barrage of bombs forcing people to move amid the threat of intensified attacks, the methodical destruction of entire neighborhoods, and the denial of humanitarian assistance underline that there appears to be a push for a permanent demographic shift in Gaza that's in defiance of international law and is tantamount to ethnic cleansing," unquote. I ask Volker Türk about his comments.
You must imagine over the last over 20 months or so that the population inside Gaza has been displaced multiple times. I've heard it directly from some of our staff who told me that they had to move from the north to the south, back to the north, and back to the south, and within these areas again and again. So it shows a group of people multiply displaced, and with the latest orders, they are essentially now confined to one-fifth of the territory. So you basically ask people to go again to one-fifth of the territory and empty up the land. That's what prompted me to call it ethnic displacement and ethnic cleansing. Hmm.
And just this past weekend, officials in Gaza say at least 81 Palestinians were killed, 400 injured, just over a day period. You have accused Israel of inflicting horrifying, unconscionable suffering on Palestinians. What is your response to the latest developments?
Well, you have seen that they established the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is essentially a militarized form of providing humanitarian assistance. We have seen at least over 600 people killed when they tried to go to these distribution points. We used to have, when the UN was still able to work a little bit more, we were having about 400 distribution points. Now it's limited to 4 or 5, and it's heavily militarized. And as a result, you see people being killed, you see chaos, because the fundamental principles of humanitarian action are not respected. So yes, humanitarian action is extremely important in these circumstances, and it's just not happening at the scale and speed that is required in order to save people's lives.
Can you talk about Israel's attack on UNRWA itself, on the UN agency?
So the fact that UNRWA was vilified in the way that it was actually shows that there is a total misunderstanding of the role of the United Nations. We are here to provide relief. We are here to help people in need. We are here also in humanitarian action to do this type of work. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to do it, and UNRWA was the prime target in all of this, which is very, very unfortunate and has really real-life consequences.
Is it a war crime?
I mean, the UNRWA, there are many things that happen in this war that are clearly war crimes. Collective punishment, issues of denying of humanitarian assistance. It's a very complex legal issue how to deal with UNRWA, and in fact, it's currently before the International Court of Justice.
I mean, the number of healthcare workers that have been killed, the hundreds of journalists who have been killed, those that are there to provide humanitarian aid. I just have to ask, the United Nations some 80 years ago was founded to end war, promote fundamental human rights, reaffirm international law. When you watch what is unfolding in Gaza, you might think the UN is totally useless.
Well, the principles are there, and the principles need to be respected. Let's not forget, why was the United Nations created? The United Nations were created after two world wars, horrific suffering, 60 million people in Europe alone displaced as refugees, the Holocaust, atrocity crimes, massive violations of human rights. There was a sentiment, never again. We are going to establish a world order that respects territorial integrity, independence, that respects human rights and international humanitarian law. And yes, 80 years later, I'm indeed shocked at what I see around the world, because we have the highest number of conflicts and utter disrespect for international law. And that is worrying and should wake us all up, because we don't need a world where anarchy reigns and chaos.
How do you see a ceasefire taking place after Iran, Israel and U.S. bombing Iran? That happened quite quickly, but not in Gaza. The violence is only intensifying.
No, I really hope, my most fervent hope is that there is a permanent ceasefire, that all the remaining hostages are released unconditionally, that indeed humanitarian aid is finally coming in at a scale and a magnitude that is required, and that there will be a political solution, which means a two-state solution. There's no way around that. And yeah, I mean, and we can never give up on any of this, even when at the moment it looks very unrealistic, but one should never ever cast this aside. That's the only solution for both Israelis and Palestinians to live side by side in peace.
That's Volker Türk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. We were speaking at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, where he had just given an address about climate change. He says men have stopped wearing ties in Europe with the heat dome so intense right now. So next up, we're going to talk about climate change and the rising temperatures with climatologist Michael Mann. Stay with us.
Man built a railroad, man first they stole our language, then they stole our names, then they stole the things that brought us fame. And they stole our neighbors, and they stole our streets, and they left us to die on Recon Beach.
Recon Beach, performed by Hooray for the Riff Raff's Linda Segarra at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour looking at climate news as a massive heat dome is bringing record temperatures to much of Europe, with forecasters warning of even more extreme heat in the coming days. Spain and Portugal just recorded their hottest ever June temperatures. Nearly two dozen cities in Italy are under red alert heat advisories. In Turkey, more than 50,000 people have evacuated fast-spreading wildfires. France also saw its first fires of the season erupt. This comes after most of North America sweltered under, to say the least, hotter-than-average temperatures in June. Scientists say the burning of fossil fuels by humans is the primary cause of global warming. This week, the Senate's debating measures to include in Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget bill is set to shape in U.S. fossil fuel policy in ways expected to accelerate fossil fuel extraction, in part by cutting hundreds of billions of dollars of clean energy incentives. In fact, taxing more clean energy incentives. This comes as the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights in the Context of Climate Change presented a new report Monday on the imperative of defossilizing our economies. This is Elisa Morguera addressing the UN Human Rights Council.
So what does defossilization mean? It entails prioritizing the phase out of fossil fuels, including various forms of financing them, within and beyond the energy sector. It means recognizing and prioritizing the phase out of fossil fuels as the single most impactful health contribution. Defossilization underscores the need to focus on fossil fuels, also in connection with the growing production of plastics and petrochemicals, which cause an additional layer of human rights harms and further diminish nature's contribution to climate regulation and human resilience. Defossilizing our economies then means tackling all the financial benefits the fossil fuel companies are still gaining.
Morguera also called for a ban on fossil fuel industry lobbying and advertising and urged criminal penalties for those who spread disinformation about the climate crisis. For more, we're joined by Michael Mann, the presidential distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science, University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability and the Media. His most recent research has been profiled in UPenn Today under the headline, Heat Domes and Flooding Have Nearly Tripled Since the 50s. His forthcoming book with Dr. Peter Hotez is titled Science Under Siege. His previous books include Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Mann. I was just in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday. The heat dome was intense, and as we know in Europe, they don't have very much air conditioning at all. It's believed tens of thousands of people have died over the last years in Europe as a result of the intense heat. Can you talk about what you have found around the intensification of the increase of heat domes from the U.S. to Europe and beyond?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. And, you know, at some level, this isn't that complicated. You make the planet hotter, you're going to have more frequent and intense heat extremes. And we are seeing that. Our climate models capture that, and they predict that that will get much worse in the future if we, you know, as you allude to, continue to burn fossil fuels and warm up the planet. At the same time, there's some subtle mechanisms when it comes to how the pattern of warming of the planet is changing the Northern Hemisphere jet stream. And some of our own research suggests that that pattern of warming, in particular, the fact that the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet, is actually changing the jet stream in such a way that it's more likely to get stuck in one of those very wavy patterns that you see on a weather map. And those waves are associated with big high and low pressure systems that alternatively mean heat, drought, and wildfires in one place, or excessive floods in other places. Those wiggles in the jet stream are tending to get larger and they get locked in place. So the same location is under a heat dome day after day, like we've seen in North America this summer, like we're seeing in Europe right now. And that mechanism is actually not very well captured in the climate models. It's an important point because critics of climate policy like to say uncertainty is a reason not to act. It's just the opposite. Our models may, in fact, be underestimating the impact that climate change is already having when it comes to these damaging and deadly weather extremes.
And Professor Mann, what exactly is a heat dome?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's just an area of very high pressure, very hot, dry air. We've seen a number of them out west in recent years. We had one here in Philadelphia. We were under one of those heat domes. We had triple digit temperatures, and it's also fairly humid in this part of the country. So you add those very high temperatures, that excessive humidity, and you're talking about deadly heat. Here in Philadelphia, we have a very large underserved population of people who are especially susceptible to heat stress. And so this is a real concern. It's not a distant concern. It's something that is impacting us now.
And meanwhile, we have the Trump administration not only moving in this new bill to reduce subsidies for solar and wind energy, but also to incentivize coal production, declaring the coal industry critical to the United States. What do you make of this direction that the current administration is going in?
Yeah, it's tragic. History will not judge them kindly, because at a time when we need to be accelerating that transition away from fossil fuels towards clean energy, they're doing just the opposite. They're doing everything they can to block the continued expansion of wind and solar and geothermal and clean energy solutions. And the rest of the world is moving on. So what we have to recognize here is that this is, even if you don't care about the climate, even if you don't care about the human health consequences, any of that, if you care about the economy, this is the worst possible thing for American competitiveness, because the rest of the world recognizes that clean energy is the future. And right now we're doubling down on antiquated fossil fuel energy in a way that is making us less and less competitive.
I want to ask you a quick question. Dr. Mann, this just happened. The U.S. Global Change Research Program's website, globalchange.gov, was taken down, along with information on how global warming is affecting the country. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, I actually encountered that yesterday. I couldn't believe my eyes when I heard that that had happened, and I went to look for those reports, those congressionally mandated national climate assessment reports. They're all gone. You can't access them online anymore. And the attitude seems to be on the part of this administration that if we pretend climate change doesn't exist, if we stop measuring it, if we stop scientists from talking about it and publishing about it, that somehow it'll just evaporate. It's such a cynical and dangerous way of looking at this problem.
I remember when I was growing up, librarians were all saying, we need paper copies of everything as the internet, took over. And I just thought they were so old fashioned, they couldn't get used to the idea that the internet was the reservoir of, all global information. But all of this is being wiped away. But let me get your response to podcaster Joe Rogan's interview with Senator Bernie Sanders. Rogan pushed back when Senator Sanders said, quote, the last 10 years have been the warmest on Earth.
There are some people who think climate change is a hoax. It ain't a hoax. I think the last 10 years have been the warmest on record. And we can create millions of good-paying jobs transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency, to solar, to wind, and other sustainable energies.
I think the climate change issue is very complicated. And I think, did you see the Washington Post piece that they wrote where they did this long-term view? First of all, the reality is that the Earth's temperature has never been static, right? We could both agree on that. It's always been up and down. There's been ice ages and heat waves. And then the Washington Post looked at it. What was the time period that they looked at? That essentially they found that we're in a cooling period. That the Earth over the past X amount of years, And this was like a very inconvenient discovery, but they had to report the data, and kudos to them for doing that.
So that's podcaster Joe Rogan interviewing Senator Bernie Sanders. Professor Michael Mann, can you respond? He says, talking about this cooling period.
Yeah, you know, they say a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And here, you know, he probably read a headline, this Washington Post headline, and didn't even understand the headline, you know, let alone actually read the article. It was about a research article that had been published, I believe, in the journal Nature, which I reviewed at the time and wrote about it. And he got it 180 degrees wrong. What that article actually showed was when you look back over tens of millions of years. And I talk about, you know, the lessons from Earth history and what we can learn from them in our fragile moment. And this is related to this article. They're looking at the changes in climate that have taken place over millions of years and using a climate model to figure out what it tells us about how sensitive the climate is to increases in CO2. Now, in the past, on hundreds of millions of year timescales, those changes in carbon dioxide are driven by very long-term changes in explosive volcanic activity, which puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere on timescales of tens of millions of years. I mean, what it shows is that the climate may actually be more sensitive to those increases in CO2. Of course, we are increasing CO2 at a much more rapid rate, a million times faster today. And if anything, what this study shows is that the climate may be more sensitive to this increase in carbon dioxide from human activity today. So he didn't understand what he was reading. He might have heard some talking points from conservative radio or television. And, you know, this is misinformation. Some would call it disinformation, intentional misinformation to mislead the public about what is arguably the greatest threat that we face.
And Professor Mann, your upcoming book, Science, is titled Science Under Siege. The battle over climate change is just part of this war on science of the Trump administration. I'm wondering if you could talk about the impact on your colleagues, on scientists across the United States as university research is being attacked, as accepted knowledge is being questioned, what this means for the future development of the scientific community in this country.
Yeah, thanks. You know, the book in a way is sadly prophetic because Peter Hotez, a public health vaccinologist, vaccine scientist, and I began writing this book more than a year ago. And we had no idea what was in store or how relevant it would be to where we are today, because it really is about this dual attack that we've seen when it comes to the science behind vaccines and the public health measures necessary to deal with pandemics like COVID-19 or the science of climate change. In both cases, we have seen the science attacked for purely ideological reasons. And as you allude to, with this current administration, we're seeing that assault now, accelerate in a way that we've never seen before. This sort of assault on the science of vaccines and COVID-19, the science of climate. And we're seeing the defunding of research in this area. We're seeing researchers attacked and vilified and threatened because of the research that they do, because it's inconvenient, again, to certain ideological interests who want to see us double down on fossil fuels, or who have bought into the idea that, you know, vaccines are a dangerous conspiracy. In both cases, the consequences are deadly. People are losing their lives, and many more people will lose their lives if we continue down this current path of anti-science that we're going down here in the United States. It's a very dangerous time for all of us. And, you know, the irony here is that this is a country that was built on science and technology. And the wonders of, you know, modern life are due to the fact that this country valued scientists and it promoted and supported scientists for decades. And now, because certain areas of science have become inconvenient, again, to certain ideologically driven individuals and groups and industries, we find science under an attack you know, again, there's almost no precedent. You have to go back to, you know, the early 1900s.
5 seconds.
Stalin's Russia. You know, the assault on scientists that happened then.
Michael Mann, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gaels!